talk about universal experience.
Thank you. So it's a very obvious type of extra dimensions, dimensions in which all the standard model fields propagate. I will start by describing what happens if there is only one extra dimension of this sort. And then I will turn to the more interesting case of two extra dimensions, which is probably the best theoretically motivated one. So as everybody discussed last week here, if you have gravity propagating in extra dimensions, gravity only, then you can find new explanations for the hierarchy between the electroweak scale and the Planck scale. And this can go if the extra dimensions are large and flat, or if there is one warped extra dimension. Another idea studied for more than a decade now is one in which it's an extra dimension in which only the gauge bosons propagate while the fermions are localized. If that's the case, then there are contributions to four fermion operators from the exchange of heavy Kaltzak-Klein modes of the gauge bosons. And it turns out that the bound on the compactification scale, it's somewhere between 4 and 70 eV, depending who you are asking. And those bounds come from a global fit to the Lepp, Tevatron, Hera, and other data. For instance, you can see there is a change in the G Fermi coming from the exchange of Kaltzak-Klein mode of a W. And therefore, these dimensions are really hard to be discovered at, even at the LHC. On the other hand, one can consider the scenario where fermions propagate as well in extra dimensions. And to give you the simplest example here, consider one extra dimension. And if you have a fermion in the full five-dimensional theory, then that fermion turns out to be a vector-like fermion from the point of view of the four-dimensional theory. In other words, when you compactify, you'll find that the Kaltzak-Klein modes are vector-like fermions. Since the standard model fermions that we see in nature are chiral two-component fermions, one has to make sure that chirality comes into play. And it turns out that you can easily do that by compactifying on an interval. An interval has some endpoints, and at the endpoints you are supposed to impose some boundary conditions. And those boundary conditions can know about chirality. So if this is your fermion, which is a function of x mu, the usual Minkowski four vector, and the coordinate of the extra dimension, which goes from 0 to L, then the left-handed fermion can have these boundary conditions, whereas the right-handed fermion can have this boundary condition. So the boundary conditions tell you about chirality, and if you look at the Kaltzak-Klein decomposition of this fermion, you find that the zero mode has only one chirality. So let's say this is the top in extra dimensions. You find that there is a right-handed top there, which is function of only our large four dimensions. And then you find the Kaltzak-Klein modes coming into in vector-like pairs. There is a right-handed and a left-handed one with Kaltzak-Klein wave functions that are cosines and sines here. So you can consider what happens if you have the whole standard model propagating in such a dimension where you have chiral boundary conditions. Actually, this idea is very simple. Before deep brains were invented, this was probably the most obvious way of proceeding if you thought about extra dimensions. Now it looks like a new thing given how much work was put into field theories with fermions localized. So Tom Appelquist, Xinqia Cheng, and myself actually realized that the bounds on the sizes of these extra dimensions are quite loose. The reason for that is that you have a Kaltzak-Klein number conservation. This is basically the statement that you have momentum conservation in the extra dimension. Now you have some boundaries, and those boundaries break momentum conservation, but they don't break it completely. You still have a Kaluza-Klein parity remaining. Basically, at the boundary you can reflect, which just turns your momentum into minus itself. So you have Kaluza-Klein number conservation mod 2. But this is very important for the phenomenology of these extra dimensions, because first of all, you cannot have a vertex with a 2-0 modes and a 1-1 mode. You see the sum here is not 0 mod 2. And it turns out that since all the experiments that we can do involve only external lines which are 0 modes, since higher modes have not been discovered, it turns out that there are no three-level contributions to the electroic observables, for instance, or no three-level contributions to any process that has been measured yet. And this is interesting because all those bonds that I mentioned before in the case where the fermions are localized go away, those were coming from the exchange of a single Kaluza-Klein gauge boson. Furthermore, it means that you cannot produce a single Kaluza-Klein mode, the first mode, let's say, in colliders. Again, in order to have this KK number conservation, you would have to pair produce them. And this is harder, and therefore works in the same direction of making those extra dimensions harder to see.
But it simply makes the threshold twice as high, or something?
No, it's more complicated because, you see, the way you look, for instance, at LEP or at the Tevatron, you have 2 0 mode fermions and 1 KK mode, and then you again have some zero mode final states. And this is S channel. You can see a bump of, or a raise in the cross section, which is very easily observed. If you pair produce two of those, things are more complicated. I'm going to talk about what are the current bounds. It's a complicated problem to find out what is the current bound from the Tevatron and what's the projected bound in RAND 2 or in the Large Hadron Collider. However, there are contributions from the Kaluza-Klein modes of this sort to electroic observables from loops. You can always take two of these one modes, form a loop, and then have two zero modes in the external lines. It turns out that you have a contribution, for instance, to the W mass from so the observed W0 mode here goes into a top 1 mode and a bottom 1 mode. And you have another contribution to the Z mass as well. It turns out that this shift in the W and Z mass is known about the isospin breaking between the top and bottom masses, because the top comes from the Yukawa of the top, which is different from the bottom. So if you try to compute the relevant electroic observable, which is called the delta rho parameter, or as well, it's similar to the T parameter, you find some contribution which is inversely proportional to the Kaluza-Klein mass squared in the loop. And then you want to sum over all these loops, and you have some numerical coefficient here which you know. It goes like the top mass to the fourth power, and this is the electroic scale squared. Now, we know from the fits to the data that this parameter has to be less than about 0.4. This is actually a function depending on the Higgs mass. And for one extra dimension, you find that a compactification scale, namely the first Kaluza-Klein masses to be at 300 GeV, is perfectly consistent with the data. For two extra dimensions, this sum is logarithmically divergent, and you have to cut it off. Now, at some point, this theory becomes strongly coupled in the ultraviolet, because this is an orinormalizable theory. It's gauge theory in five dimensions. The gauge coupling goes like the inverse square root of the scale, and therefore you need some cutoff. However, you can find out where is that cutoff. Is basically the scale where the gauge interactions of the standard model become non-perturbative. And since you have only a log dependence on that cutoff, you can estimate the bound on 1 over R for two extra dimensions, which is somewhere between 3 and 600 GeV. Now, you can find many other bounds, for instance, coming from flavor physics. You have B to S gamma processes, again, with loops with Kautz-Klein modes, and those have a G mechanism in a similar way with what happens for the zero modes, and therefore these are not very strong bounds. On the other hand, they are not much weaker than these ones. They are, again, in the 2 to 300 GeV range. There is also a mu to E gamma bound contribution, for instance. Now, there are various consequences of the fact that you have this Kautz-Klein parity conservation. One of them is that the lightest Kautz-Klein particle is stable. And therefore, if it happens to be a neutral one, it could be a good dark matter candidate. It turns out, actually, that the lightest Kautz-Klein particle, with the simplest assumptions that you can make about the standard model in extra dimension, turns out to be the photon 1 mode. So this is based on the assumption that you have no higher dimensional operators localized at the fixed points of your orbifold, which is probably a legitimate assumption. Now, if this photon 1 mode is the Kautz-Klein, the lightest Kautz-Klein particle, is being shown by Geraldine Servan and Tim Tate that it is a viable dark matter candidate. Actually, it is in the right ballpark of masses for having the right density, and the couplings are also in the ballpark. They found that actually you want the mass of the first Kautz-Klein mode to be between 0.6 and 1.6 TeV and 1 TeV, and for two extra dimensions, actually those bonds are a little bit tighter. And then you have a very strong bond on the mass coming from the condition of not overclosing the universe during the Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So the bottom line here is that those extra dimensions have to have a compactification scale that is somewhere between 300 GeV and 1.5 TeV. And this is very good news. Since we have an upper bound, it means we are going to know in the near future whether those things exist or not. You cannot push them forever. Actually, if you just
take a different picture of, I mean, this is dependent on quantification kind of for the interval. What you have a different type of?
Well, if you have only one extra dimension, you don't have too many options. How can you compactify one extra dimension such that you have some boundaries? It has to be an interval, right?
You can have a circle.
The circle has no boundary, and therefore there is no chirality that you can introduce.
You can. I explained it in my lecture. You can. You can have a domain wall on a circle. And
sure, but those are not universal extra dimensions, right? So then, oops. The starting point is this word universal, which means that everybody propagates everywhere. If you have a domain wall, as you mentioned, then you have stronger bounds coming from the exchange of a single Kautz-Klein mode.
Excuse me? Does it come back on itself? How can you have just one? I would think that you
do. Well, it's not a standard dominant wall, but if you have some.
Sorry, I didn't hear your talk.
Yeah. Well, if you have a field theory, and the field theory is a field in a target space has a non-contractible cycle.
I see that.
So then you map a circle onto this cycle, and you can have a different type of a domain walls, but it carries chirality because it's orientable. Whether it's mapping in clockwise or anti-clockwise, it knows about chirality.
Sure, that's perfectly fine, but that domain wall breaks momentum, and therefore you again have very strong bounds from LEP and Tevatron data. So this is a deviation from the universality condition that I like to impose here. And trying to answer this question about how the bounds from the collider scale with this notion of universality, well, here's the typical picture for what would happen at the Tevatron in RAN 2 if those things would be observed. So these are proton, anti-proton experiments. You take a quark and an anti-quark and you collide them. This is a gluon, a usual gluon, zero mode, and then you pair produce these two quark one modes. And then there is a whole sequence of Tieske decays here. Probably I should have shown you what's the typical spectrum for the Kaluza-Klein masses. This has been computed in a recent paper by Schmaltz, Machev, and Cheng. It turns out that you have all the Kaluza-Klein one modes very degenerate, close to this 1 over R, but with small splittings coming from loops. And the typical scenario is that where a quark decays to a quark zero mode that looks like a jet in your detector, then you have a Z1 mode, which then decays to a lepton zero mode, which can be identified in the detector, and then there is this lepton one mode, which again decays to a lepton zero mode and a photon one mode. Now this is missing energy, but you are left with two leptons here. And if you have on the other side from this quark, anti-quark, something similar, you have a four lepton signal plus missing energy. And Cheng, Machev, and Schmaltz in another paper actually computed what's the reach in at the Tevatron in Rant and at the LHC for discovering that. It turns out that if the mass is not of the first mode, not higher, much higher than 300 GeV, you can actually probe this in RAN 2 at the Tevatron. But the better news is that for up to 1.5 TeV, which is this bond coming from dark matter, you can probe the whole range of compactification scales at the LHC.
What are we looking at on the y-axis?
Sorry?
What is the y-axis?
No, this is the luminosity. It tells you how much you're running. For the LHC, you typically want, you'll have about 100 inverse femtobarns. For the Tevatron, about 10 or 20. It tells you how much you have to run the collider to see those things. Okay. So that's the story about one universal extra dimension. It's very interesting phenomenologically. There are lots of signals one will be able to see if those things are there. On the other hand, from a theoretical point of view, the case of two extra dimensions is much more interesting. So I'll spend some time explaining how this goes. The interesting thing about six dimensions is that the total number of dimensions is even. And it turns out that the Lorentz group in 3 plus delta, where delta is an integer in the notation of Keith Dinus, has chiral representations only for when this is even. And it makes sense to think about the smallest number of extra dimensions, which is even, namely d equals 6. However, if you repeat what I'm going to say now for more dimensions, you'll find that things are not so interesting, actually. And that's because of properties of gamma matrices. You know that 6 dimensions looks more like 10, whereas 8 looks more like 4. In 8 dimensions, there is nothing very spatial going on, whereas in 6 you have. Now, in 6 dimensions, the Clifford algebra includes gamma matrices from gamma 0 to gamma 5. And there is something similar to gamma 5 from 4 dimensions, namely a product of all these gamma matrices, which defines chirality. You have chirality projection operators with 1 plus minus the product of all these gamma matrices. And I'm going to call the 6-dimensional chiralities plus and minus, as opposed to left and right for 4 dimensions. Now, that in the Dirac representation, the charge conjugation operator is a product of 3 gamma matrices. And that's different than the case of 4 dimensions where you have only 2 of them. One implication here is that chirality is invariant under charge conjugation. And another way of saying the same thing is you cannot write down Majorana masses in 6 dimensions. And that's interesting for a variety of purposes, including neutrinos. Again, this is a property in 6 plus 4k dimensions only. No, you can write only Dirac masses, actually, in 6D. I believe it's not the option.
But the Weyl fermion can be
that's only in 10 dimensions, I believe. That's a property mod 8. All the properties of the Lorentz group are mod 8, but some are mod 4, and this is one. So the fermions here are indeed, the Weyl fermions are 4-component fermions. If you compactify on a torus, you'll find that this four-component fermion becomes a left and a right four-dimensional fermion, so, which is, again, vector-like. So you have to do something about chirality as well. But it's not hard to compactify on an orbifold and obtain four-dimensional chirality. So basically, you just project out one chirality of each zero mode. Now, there is an interesting story with the anomalies. So in six dimensions, the anomalies are much more constraining than in four dimensions. And the reason for that is that the local gauge anomalies are no longer triangle diagrams. They are actually square diagrams. And you find many anomalies, such as SU3 square, SU2 square, SU3 square, U1 square, and so on. Well, it turns out that all these anomalies can be canceled by a Green-Schwarz mechanism. Basically, you want this square diagram plus the exchange of a B mu nu field to give a zero. So these are actually the gauge bosons. This is the B mu nu field, an anti-symmetric tensor. And if you have the sum of this plus the sum of all the square diagrams zero, then there is no anomaly. And you can always do that for this kind of factorizable anomalies. There is, however, an anomaly which you cannot cancel with a Green-Schwarz mechanism of this sort, namely the SU3 cube U1. And if you want your U1 hypercharge, so the name of the game here is that you want to have below the compactification scale the four-dimensional standard model as we know it. So we want, for instance, U1 hypercharge to be unbroken at the compactification scale. Now, just looking at this square anomaly, you find that this is proportional to whatever comes from the quarks. Only the quarks are charged under both SU3 and U1. So the quark doublet, so you have two because it's an SU2 doublet here, has a hypercharge 1/3. And then you have the up and down type quark singlets, so with the hypercharges 4/3 and -2/3. These are the usual standard model couplings. And now the only option that you have is to change the chirality, the six-dimensional chirality of these fields. So you can consider a plus or a minus in front of these things. It turns out that the only way you can have zero here, so that there is no anomaly of this sort, is when you have minus here and minus there. In other words, if you choose the chirality of the quark doublet to be plus, then the quark singlets, the up and down type, have to have chirality minus. Which means that, among other things, QCD is vector-like in six dimensions. And this is not the end of the story, because as opposed to the 4D case, in six dimensions you have gravitational anomalies, local gravitational anomalies. And those are given again by square diagrams with gravitons on the external lines and fermions in the loop. It turns out that the only thing that matters for the gravitational anomaly is the number of fermions. Basically, the number of fermions with plus chirality minus the number with negative chirality. So this gravitational anomaly is proportional to this number. And just by counting how many fermions you have in each generation in the standard model, generation of fermions, you find that the number of fermions is odd, and you cannot have this to be zero. However, there is a very simple solution for the case to have this equal to zero, namely you add one right-handed fermion per generation, right-handed neutrino. In other words, you add one gauge singlet fermion within each generation, and then you can have this gravitational anomaly to be zero. Newton's law works fine. Everything is well defined. So using all these constraints that I told you so far, you can write down one fermion generation in six dimensions. Maybe you have the quarks doublet and singlet with chirality plus, minus, and minus. And then in order to satisfy this condition, the leptons can have plus for the doublet and minus for the singlets. This is the right-handed electron, if you like. Or you can reverse all the lepton chiralities. So there are only two chirality assignments that you can entertain.
So on the rule of that assignment is compatible, for instance, SO10, if you assume a kind of SO10.
No, actually, none of them is compatible with SO10 in the usual four-dimensional case where U and Q are part of the same of the same multiplet because they have different chiralities. Now, if you have different different representations for Q and U, you can do it. But so the constraints are very strong in six dimensions, and they give you different results.
Just animal cancellation for this that you cannot have the SO10 in six dimensions in a conventional manner.
Right. On the other hand, you can imagine SO10 in 10 dimensions where Q and U are part of the same multiplet, and then when you compactify from six to from 10 to 6, you can have different chirality for them. So, okay.
SO10, but it has to be vector-like, 6D.
Right.
The constraints are strong on chirals.
Right. So, sure. So in the vector-like case, you would have a different representation for Q and a different one for U. And I'm still not done with the constraints from anomalies. You see, this is interesting that in six dimensions you have lots of constraints, but it turns out that in the end none of them is bad. Actually, they are good. And I'm going to show you a really interesting one. Namely, you know, you are probably familiar with the SU2 global anomaly in four dimensions. That so-called Witten anomaly tells you that you have to have an even number of doublets in order for your theory to be well defined. Well, in six dimensions, the condition is much stronger again. And the reason for that is that the homotopy group in six dimensions for SU2 is Z12, as opposed to the four dimensional case where it's just a Z2. Now, this 12 tells you that you need a larger number of doublets so that there is no global anomaly. And it turns out that, as Bershadsky and Vafa show, that the total number of doublets has to be a multiple of 6 for the theory to be well-defined. Now, we can just count how many doublets we have them there from what I told you before. It turns out that you have within each generation, you have a quark doublet. So that means 3 doublets and for the colors. And then you have one lepton, which can have chirality plus or minus. So here you have 1. Now you can take 3 plus or plus 1 or 3 minus 1. You still don't get 6, which tells you that one generation is not enough for the standard model to make sense in 6 dimensions. And actually, if you go along this line and you assume that the number of generation that all the generations have identical chiralities, you find that the number of generation has to be a multiple of 3. And this was a great thing that Eric Popitz and I were very happy to recognize, that you can imagine that the motivation for the existence of three generation is this six-dimensional constraint. So again, constraints are very strong, but they work fine. They go in the direction that nature likes them to be so far. The story I told you about six dimensions so far refers only to the uncompactified case. So we have to compactify those two extra dimensions since we don't see them around. And the simplest way of compactifying them is to consider a square torus. So you take this square equal sides here, going from the coordinates of the two extra dimensions going from minus pi r to plus pi r. Well, when you compactify this way, you break the Lorentz symmetry from the six-dimensional Lorentz symmetry. It turns out that, first of all, by picking two dimensions to be special, you break SO5,1 down to SO3,1 times a U1 symmetry, which is rotation in the space of these two extra dimensions. And then by choosing a square, you break this U1 down to a Z4 symmetry, apparently. Namely, rotations by 90 degrees should leave the theory invariant. However, it turns out that the fermions, when you rotate them by 360 degrees, they change sign. Basically, the statement here is that generators of the Lorentz group for the fermions have a 1/2 in them. So you have to go twice around the circle, which means that actually the remaining symmetry is a Z8. So SO5,1 is broken down to the usual four-dimensional Lorentz symmetry, but you are left with this Z8 discrete symmetry. This is work done in collaboration with Tom Appelquist, Eduardo Ponton, and Hong Yi at Yale. And this Z8 symmetry is very interesting. One can work out easily what are the fermion charges under this Z8. It turns out that the fermions, let's say the quarks that have zero modes, namely the quark doublet that is left-handed and the quark singlets that are right-handed, all have a charge minus 1/2. The other ones, the quarks that don't have zero modes, have the opposite Z8 charge. Again, this comes only by looking at the generators of the Lorentz group in six dimensions and seeing who's who there for left and right. Now, for the leptons, you have two chirality assignments possible, plus for this lepton doublet or minus, and these are correlated. And in any case, you have the same sign here. If you have chirality plus, then you have minus 1/2 for the fits with zero modes. So based on these charges, you can find out a selection rule for any operator that involves only zero modes. You know, the operators involving zero modes are the interesting ones for the phenomenological purposes so far, because no higher modes have been discovered. So besides this Z8, you have to impose SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 invariance, the usual gauge invariance. And since these quarks have a baryon number 1/3 and the leptons have lepton numbers minus one, you find this conservation law or selection rule. Namely, that three times the baryon number of any operator consistent with the symmetry, plus or minus, depending on which chirality assignment you pick, the number, the lepton number of that operator has to be a multiple of 8. So you can stare at this and find various consequences. First of all, you recover the result that I told you before, namely that there are no Majorana masses. A Majorana neutrino mass, for instance, is delta B equals 0, delta L equals 2. And this is definitely not mod 8, 0 mod 8. More generally, there is no neutrino less double beta decay, because these are, again, delta B equals 0, delta L equals 2 processes. There are no neutron-anti-neutron oscillations. These are the delta B equals 2, delta L equals 0 operators. But what's most remarkable in my mind is what happens with proton decay operators, which I'm going to show you in a little bit of detail right now. So first of all, one has to recognize that gauge theory, such as the standard model, in more than four dimensions, it's always a non-normalizable theory, which at some point you see perturbation theory breaks down, some new physics should take over. And you can find out where this scale lies. It's typically 5 or 10 times the compactification scale. At that scale, you find a perturbation theory parameter such as alpha strong times the number of colors times the number of Kaltza Klein modes to become of order 1. And therefore, at that scale, you can expect the most general set of higher dimensional operators to appear. And that sounds worrisome. For instance, why wouldn't you write down a proton decay operator such as QQQL? And actually, this is a problem for almost any theory beyond the standard model. Within the standard model, you can write down such an operator, which is suppressed by some two powers of some new scale. And since we don't know anything about physics above the TeV scale, this can be the TeV scale. And then you'll find that the proton would decay with a lifetime which is 60 orders of magnitude faster than the one observed. Okay. So the current bound is some 10 to the 33 years for proton decay. Well, it turns out that in our context here, the Z8 symmetry does not allow operators of this form. So this is good. It gives you an explanation for why the proton is very long-lived, if not stable. And to see that, consider first this L plus chirality assignment. Now, a proton decay operator has to be a delta B equals 1. So you need three quarks or three anti-quarks in your operator. So you can write three quarks here. Now, based on the Z8 symmetry, you see that you cannot write anything except if you have three anti-leptons together going with these three quarks. And then you can try all the possibilities and so that your operator is SU2 cross U1 invariant. It turns out that the first one that you find is dimension 17. It involves three anti-leptons, three quarks, and one Higgs. So now even if this coefficient is order 1 and this scale is of order a couple of TeV, the proton lifetime is sufficiently long, consistent with the data. Actually, it turns out that such an operator would allow only decays in five-body decays of the proton, involving an electron, two pions, and two neutrinos. And you can work out what's the lifetime here. You find typically 10 to the 35 years, although there are large uncertainties. For instance, coming from where is this number? You see that you have the 22nd power. If you change this instead of 5, you make it 6, this becomes twice as big, for instance. But in any case, this seems to be perfectly safe. It's a good explanation for why the proton is stable. You can play the same game in the case of L minus chirality. There you'll find actually dimension 15 operators suppressed only by 9 powers of this scale. And there you have a better chance for actually discovering proton decay. Furthermore, you have 4-body decay modes. But these are no details. I can go over them only if you are really interested. Are there any questions so far?
So is it compatible with baryogenesis?
Well, you see, first of all, baryogenesis, if it happens at the electroweak scale, maybe it happens below the compactification scale. One has to say how baryogenesis occurs here. But in principle, there is one additional nice story that I should tell here. Namely, you know that in the four-dimensional case, there is an SU2 anomaly for the baryon number. And which, in a sense, tells you that operators of this sort are produced in the early universe, so that protons are generated. Now, in our case, in the six-dimensional theory, you don't see such anomaly for the baryon number. On the other hand, instantons in the four-dimensional theory below the compactification scale are still supposed to break baryon number. Now, there is no contradiction between these two statements. This is an effect below the compactification scale, and this could be relevant for baryon number generation. The cosmology of this scenario has not been worked in too much detail, and it would be interesting to see. What we know for sure from cosmology, namely what happened after Big Bang nucleosynthesis, works fine, because there you really have the four-dimensional theory. What happens at scales above 100 GeV or so, it's less constrained and has not been worked out here, except for these bounds from dark matter.
Have you considered the supersymmetric version of this one?
Actually, you cannot write a simple supersymmetric version of this for the following reason. In six dimensions, minimal supersymmetry, which is a 1-0 supersymmetry, requires that all the genos have a certain chirality and all the hypermultiplets have the opposite chirality. Now, if you remember, I said at some point that Q has chirality plus. Let's say you can always pick one of them. Then U and D have chirality minus. And therefore, there is no way of having hypermultiplets with a different chirality here in n equals 1 supersymmetry in 6 dimensions. So this scenario is not consistent. For instance, if you try to take the MSSM and put it in 6 dimensions, you would not succeed because of these anomalies. On the other hand, you can imagine having a hair symmetry, such as 1, 1. Now, this is a vector-like supersymmetry. There is no problem with any anomaly constraint. But at the same time, you have to invent a way of breaking this large number of supersymmetries, and that's something I'm not willing to do here. So the assumption is that supersymmetry is broken if supersymmetry is relevant for nature, is broken before the theory compactifies to 6 dimensions. Okay, so one worry that you might have by now is what happens with neutrinos. I kept telling you that Majorana neutrino masses are not allowed, and they are very often invoked as the source of the neutrino oscillations that have been seen in nature. Even before that, there is the question of why the neutrinos are very light. Well, you can still write Dirac neutrino masses in this scenario. Basically, this is the lepton doublet. This is the gauge singlet that becomes the right-handed neutrino. This is the Higgs field. This is a dimensionless Yukawa coupling, and now this is the scale of new physics where this six-dimensional standard model breaks down. Since there is no way of writing a Majorana mass, you cannot have a seesaw mechanism that would explain why the neutrino mass is very low. You can imagine some symmetry reason for why this coefficient is much, much smaller than 1, but there is another possibility to consider that there are other extra dimensions transverse to these universal ones that would allow a dilution of the wave function. This is an idea studied very often in the last 3 or 4 years, starting with Keith Dinas and others. And I'm going to show you an existence proof at this, or actually a whole well-defined scenario that allows you to have the right ballpark masses here without making assumptions about these coefficients to be small. So if you think in terms of some more fundamental theories, as I said, the six-dimensional standard model can be only an effective field theory below some scale. Now, even explaining the hierarchy between this scale and the Planck scale in principle requires some new physics, and a simple connection with the work done along these lines of explaining the hierarchy is really to assume that transverse to this two universal extra dimensions, you have another dimension which is warped. So that would be Randall's syndrome scenario in 6 plus 1 dimensions rather than 4 plus 1. In terms of the Randall's syndrome scenario, that would mean that your end brains of your interval are actually 5 brains, and they are the place where you stuck the standard model. So this is the 7th dimension, which here I think I'm calling X6, and here you have the 6th dimensional standard model. In the bulk here, you can have gravity for sure, but you can also assume that all the gauge singlet fields propagate there. And the gauge singlet fields are exactly this N field cancellation of gravitational. So consider this, then you can write down the most general 7-dimensional action. This, of course, if you like, can come from M theory if you compactify four dimensions first. But I'm not going to say any more things about M theory here. So since this 7th dimension can be warped, if I want to write the most general thing, I can write a covariant kinetic term for this N fields. And then, in principle, I want to write down as well a mass for these N fields. Now, if you remember what I said about N fields, namely that they have to have a 6-dimensional chirality of a certain kind, it turns out that you need to compactify this dimension on a S1 over Z2 orbifold. So, again, you want to impose chirality conditions. And this means that the n bar n, the only Dirac mass term you can write down there, is not invariant under this Z2 orbifold transformation. On the other hand, it's very easy to include a scalar field that couples to n bar n, and this scalar field is odd and acquires a vacuum expectation value, then you find a mass for n bar n. So I'm writing here really the most general seven-dimensional action with the gauge field, with the kinetic terms for this n field and this phi field, and then the standard model localized at the endpoint, and also all the interactions between phi and n possible. So this first involves a potential for phi that is chosen so that you have a vacuum expectation value. Then you have Yukawa couplings of phi to n bar n. You can always do a flavored transformation that makes this diagonal. But then you can write down hair-dimensional operators. You know, there is no reason to stop at the first Yukawa term because this is already non-renormalizable. It's suppressed by 3/2 powers of this M star, the fundamental scale. So in an effective field theory, I'm supposed to write all the terms consistent with the symmetries. So the next term is actually quite interesting. It involves two derivatives of phi and n bar n. Since I already diagonalized this term, I cannot flavor diagonalize this term. So in principle, you have couplings here that depend on the generation I and j of these two gauge singlet fields. So the metric in this seventh dimension is written to look like the Randall-Sundrum scenario here. Now, I should say that in the end, nothing related to neutrino masses depends on whether your extra dimension is warped or not. You can always take the curvature k of those of these extra dimensions to be zero, and you will still find viable neutrino mass pattern. But since I also want to solve the hierarchy problem, let me keep k to be there. You can decompose this field, which is the plus chirality of this seven-dimensional fermion, in a bunch of four-dimensional fields, and then the interaction from the standard model, which is on the brain, between the Higgs, the right-handed neutrino, and the lepton doublet looks like that, with some profile of the wave function here. And of course, once the Higgs acquires a vacuum expectation value, this is a mass matrix for the neutrino, so Dirac neutrino mass matrix. You have some volume suppressions that you don't care too much. What you really care here is how does this wave function of the fermion in the bulk look at the standard model brain. So this n will have a wave function of this form. And actually, you can compute exactly what's the value of this wave function here. What you want first is to find out what's the vacuum expectation value of your scalar. And it turns out that you can write down the equation of motion. This is a vacuum expectation value that depends on the coordinate of this extra dimension. The solution looks like that. And you can understand the behavior given that the field has boundary conditions such that it cancels at the boundaries. This is because it's an odd field so that it couples to n bar n. So you have to have zero here. And if the size of this extra dimension is sufficiently large, obeying this condition actually, where m phi is the mass in the bulk of this phi field, you find that it is almost a constant through the whole bulk. And now you want to find out what's the profile of the fermions in the bulk. And
right.
Yes, please. No, because you have a potential, you have a negative mass squared in the bulk.
Oh, so you're saying that's a stable?
Right. So, this is stable, yes. We actually checked that the second derivatives are positive here, and it's not there. Of course, It's our choice that the mass squared in the bulk is negative, but that's a 50% probability in without additional knowledge, right? So now, given that I know the profile, I can just write down the profile of the scalar wave. I can write down what's the profile of the fermion. Again, the equation of motion for the fermion wave function is something like that. That now depends on the vacuum expectation value, which I call F for this phi field. So it depends on F. It depends on the second derivative of F. And something interesting happens. And there is no wonder that if you have a scalar profile of this sort and then you have a fermion coupled to it, you find something of this form. What's the important thing here is that you have a different flavor behavior. You have three different generations, so there are three different fields in the bulk. In principle, you expect... Yeah.
This fermion is filling two kinds of backgrounds. One is the warp metric, and the other is the scalar profile.
Right. So you combine them in this way. You can solve the equations, and you find that the exponential dependence here is m phi minus the curvature over 2.
Do you guys assume the scalar profile doesn't back react on the metric?
Yes. Yes. We assume that that the mass of the phi field in the bulk is more than the fundamental scale, because otherwise you don't know how to solve it. So if you look here at the three different flavors, in principle you'll find an exponential hierarchy. You find again and again this statement in the literature that if you have more flavors in the bulk, they will have an exponentially suppressed wave function at this endpoint compared to the others. Well, this is not what we find here. And the reason for that is because we have these higher dimensional operators, which there is absolutely no reason to neglect. And it turns out that the ratio of different wave functions here is actually limited by the hierarchy between different flavors coming from these higher dimensional operators. This H1, HI3 is some unknown coefficient of the higher dimensional operators. Is in principle of order 1. And then you have this fundamental scale squared. And then you have the derivative of the vacuum expectation value. Now, the derivative here is 0. On the other hand, in this region, it's quite important. And the typical size of this derivative is given by the mass, by this height of the potential, or height of the vacuum expectation value, if you like, over the distance that you have to find the variation at the endpoint here. And this is something which is smaller than order 1 because of this large cutoff mass. On the other hand, it's not exponential hierarchy. So you typically find a hierarchy which is, you know, order 10, maybe 100. But not exponential hierarchy. And this is good because the spectrum that we see in nature is not actually exponential. If you allow me to make a connection now with the data from the neutrino oscillation experiments. Well, let me first show you what sort of mass matrix you find here. So the mass matrix is the one that I showed you earlier, is this coefficient of the Dirac operator, of the Dirac mass operator. And the only additional input that we have is this hierarchy of different wave functions. And you find there is some mass scale that sets all the neutrino mass masses, which is exponentially small compared to the electroweak scale. So this is the electroweak scale, 250 GeV, and then you have this small exponential. This small exponential knows about the vacuum expectation value of the phi field, and it also knows about the warp factor, as Eric mentioned. Now, if you turn the curvature to zero, you still have an exponentially small thing because of this profile. And then you have some numbers which are not much smaller than order 1. So you can easily adjust these parameters to find the exponential hierarchy between between the electroweak scale and the neutrino masses. But then the interesting thing is the structure, the flavor structure of this neutrino mass matrix. You have one column here which corresponds to the third generation, which has entries given by those unknown Yukawa couplings. Well, you can assume that they are all of the same order, in which case you find that there is a mixing angle between these two, between the neutrinos corresponding to these two entries, which is large. Same entries means a mixing angle of order one. But this is exactly what is seen in neutrino experiments, the atmospheric neutrino experiments, large mixing angle between the second and third neutrinos. And then here you have this epsilon parameter, which is the small ratio, which is not sufficiently small to be exponential. So this is the number of order 0.1 or so that I mentioned before. And these are, again, numbers of order 1. These couplings are known coefficients of all the operators. So what you find is that there is a hierarchy between the eigenvalues of these two columns and the eigenvalue here. And you find large mixing angles everywhere here. So if you compare with the data, there are basically three pieces of the data that are important here from neutrino oscillation. One is the scale. Basically, there is a mass scale for solar neutrino oscillation, and there is another mass scale for atmospheric neutrino oscillations. And the ratio here comes from this mass matrix that I showed you to be of order epsilon squared, which epsilon, again, is given by the ratio between the mass of this bulk scalar and the cutoff of your theory. So it's order 0.1. So this turns out to be order 10 to the minus 2, and is perfectly consistent with what is now called the large mixing angle solution to the solar neutrino problem. For the atmospheric neutrino data, we just can say that the mixing angle is given by a ratio of Yukawa couplings, which has to be order 1, and the data constrains this quantity to be between 0.65 and 1.55. So that's perfectly consistent with the data. Of course, if this interval will start shrinking, if the data will prefer to shrink this interval close to 1, which would be maximal mixing, then you would have to find an explanation for why this ratio is so close to 1. A priori, there is no reason for that. And finally, there are these reactor neutrino experiments, the Shu reactor, which constrains the third mixing angle, the one between the first and third generation neutrinos. And this constraint is that the sign of this angle should be less than 0.26. Well, in our theory with the mass matrix that I showed you, it turns out that this is given by a ratio of Yukawa couplings, which with order one parameter here can very well satisfy this bound. So overall, the neutrinos come out nicely here, actually much nicer than in usual gut scenarios, where the large mixing angle solution, which is the one preferred nowadays, is not very. For what? Theta 1-2 has to be large as well, because it's the mixing between these first two columns, and a priori all these numbers are order 1, so you find a mixing of order 1.
Okay?
Exactly. Right. This is the miracle of this wave functions, that it gives you large mixing angles and still a hierarchy of eigenvalues which is not very large. Okay.
So what would happen if in future experiment can improve the bound on this setup once by one order of magnitude?
Oh, so if they would improve, as I said, this maximal mixing of the atmospheric data.
If I'm talking about Shu bound.
Ah. Okay. So in principle, this cannot be much, much smaller than 1. there is no reason here, unless you invent some flavor symmetry or something else. Right. So furthermore, you can say that there is a prediction here that this is not much more than the current value, and you would have to see these oscillations right around the corner. By 2005, we will know much better this value. And actually, there is another important experimental test here. If double beta, neutrinoless double beta decay is observed, then this whole scenario dies. However, if neutrinoless double beta decay is not seen, then you cannot rule it in necessarily. The best way to test this is really doing collider experiments and looking for Kaltz-Klein modes of all the standard model particles. And furthermore, if you then start seeing some at 1 over r and then another one at square root of 2 over r and so on, then you start being very happy. So let me just conclude here. Those universal extra dimensions are interesting from a phenomenological point of view because they can be right close to the electroweak scale. And the Tevatron, the Large Hadron Collider, the potential next linear collider, have to discover this Kaltz-Klein modes if this scenario is correct. But from a more theoretical point of view, the case of two extra dimensions is most important. And the reason for that is, first, you have strong constraints from anomalies in six dimensions. And second, because you have this six-dimensional Lorentz invariance, which is not broken completely and leaves something there. So the anomaly constraint tells you that there should be a multiple of three generations. The Lorentz symmetry or whatever is left over tells you that the proton should be long-lived. And then accommodating the neutrino masses, it's easy, as I showed you, although the result is completely different than the usual framework in the minimal supersymmetric standard model, where all the neutrinos are of the Majorana type at low energy, whereas here they are of the Dirac type. In a sense, you have twice as many degrees of freedom. For each observed neutrino, you have a right-handed neutrino as well. And then there is the dark matter test here. So.
Could you explain again what's the origin of the smallness of the mass gap ratio in neutrino oscillations?
Right. So that comes from the hierarchy between this wave function and the next wave function, because this would be.
What were those two again?
So these are the third generation. Right-handed neutrino wave function at the standard model brain. You have the six-dimensional standard model here and the right-handed neutrinos in the bulk. So the third generation is here, the second generation here. The ratio between the masses, which are proportional with the wave functions here of the third and second generation, is the one that sets the ratio between the atmospheric and solar scales. Okay? Now, without hard-dimensional operators, this is an exponentially small scale. And actually, that has been studied by Grossman and Neubert. And they found that you have to fine-tune some parameters to make this exponential hierarchy not that large. In our case, the hard-dimensional operators that you can write enforce this to go together, basically. These two runnings are together. And the only hierarchy comes from the phi field mass, which is a bulk mass, squared over the fundamental theory, the fundamental scale where you cut off this theory. Now, this, since there is no supersymmetry, this is, turns out to be close to this one. You know, quadratic divergences push this parameter close to the cutoff. On the other hand, you cannot assume this to be very close to the cutoff because then you no longer have trust in your effective theory. So this has to be smaller than one, but not much, much smaller than one. So if you have a 10 to the minus 2 or whatever here based on naturality grounds, that sets the ratio between the atmospheric and solar scales.
Go ahead.
you have some kind of selection rules based upon the G8s. And that selection is respected by the total cortex in the standard model and this.
No, actually, if you just look here, this is not Z8 invariant. On the other hand, it turns out that you can write down some operator with the zero mode of the beam union field here. Because, you see, this Z8 is a subgroup of Lorentz symmetry in six dimensions. And we enforced from the beginning that the Lorentz symmetry anomalies cancel, which are equivalent with the gravitational anomalies.
Situation with the axial masses in this?
So now that I open this, I have to explain this B45. I sort of shortcutted the talk at some point. This B45 field is the zero mode of B mu nu with mu and nu in the extra-dimensional directions. And the zero mode here, in principle, can be light, and therefore can be observable in nature. There is one thing that generates a mass for this, namely the QCD anomaly. And if that would be the only source of the B45 mass, then you would find that the strong CP problem is solved. On the other hand, this is ruled out because the B45 field would be way too light and there are lots of experimental constraints. So you want to make this more massive. And it turns out that it's not hard to make it massive. You just want to make it more massive than the supernova temperature. So it has to be above a few hundred MeV or so. And let me just give you a scenario where this becomes massive. If you take this scenario that I told about with the six-dimensional standard model localized here and the bulk in the seventh dimension, so this sort of comes from the Horava-Witten M theory where you compactify four dimensions. So if you start indeed with this six dimension plus one plus some four small dimensions, you have an E8 field, E8 gauge theory here and an E8 gauge theory here. Well, both of them have to couple to this B mu nu field. So once you compactify four dimensions, whatever is left over here has to couple to B mu nu as well as this one. So what we know is that this is broken down to the standard model gauge group in six dimensions. This has to be broken down to some non-abelian gauge group that couples to B mu nu, and then that would be a good source for a B mu nu B45 mass. And all you want is to have the scale of this, of whatever is left of this, okay, to be higher than the QCD scale. Okay. Maybe there are some smarter ways to deal with this B45. Maybe they are just around the corner, but this is a way of hiding them.
But the B45 could be a twisted field which didn't couple to the other wall. Okay, just fine.
Yeah, of course. Or you can imagine that there is nothing left over here when you compactify. I'm not saying this is a theorem. I'm saying there is a scenario where it works.
You can make also the same thing for B mu nu.
To make what?
B-mu-nu.
No, the B mu nu has no other zero mode except B45. So all the other components. So there is a B mu nu field, but you have to impose some boundary conditions on it as well. And it turns out that, now you have some options on how to impose those boundary conditions. You can arrange that there is nothing left in the low energy except this one.
No more questions. Let's stand speak again.